From WIPR, I'm Sheila Kast. We're on the record. Two archaeologists and scores of volunteers have been probing, digging, sifting, and cataloging to unearth the mysteries hidden under a park in the city's northeast corner. A big manor house no one knew about, and more. What have they learned about the power families of old Baltimore? We meet the archaeologists who direct the Herring Run Archaeology Project, Jason Schellenhammer and Lisa Krause. They entice their neighbors to get their hands dirty alongside them, digging up stories that reveal the past.
If the history of a community or a city is being discovered and created from what we find, I think it's great for the people who live there to have a role in that.
It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Kast. We're On the Record. A good storyteller draws people in with well-crafted words. Our guests today use artifacts to piece together a narrative and to entice others to get their hands dirty alongside them, digging up stories that reveal the past. Archaeologists Lisa Krause and Jason Schellenhammer direct the Herring Run Archaeology Project in Northeast Baltimore's Herring Run Park. The project is unearthing details of surprising connections to many of Baltimore's prominent families. They'll talk about their findings Sunday afternoon at the Garrett Jacobs Mansion on Mount Vernon Place. Krause is a staff archaeologist with the Maryland Environmental Service, working with the State Highway Administration. Welcome to On the Record.
Thank you.
And Schellenhammer is senior project archaeologist at Rummel, Klepper & Kahl Civil Engineering Firm. Welcome to On the Record.
Thank you very much.
What made you think to start digging up an area in Herring Run Park? I mean, tell us how this project got started.
We moved to Lauraville in 2012, and the park is really close to our house. So we were there really frequently, and as we were walking around in the park with our dogs, we started noticing these historical features that were visible on the landscape.
Like?
And there's a mill race that runs alongside one of the jogging trails, and just the entire landscape as a whole is, it just looks what we call sighty. There are a lot of promising archaeological locations in that park. And
a mill race, for example, I think I would look at it maybe and think there's a stream.
Yes.
Why did it shout mill to you?
It has a very distinctive shape, and it's right off the trail. And at first I was just thinking, okay, wow, there's a weird little ditch over here. But then the more I walked by it, I started looking at it differently and thinking, no, this looks like a mill race. And if there's a mill race, it usually goes to a mill. So we were already kind of exploring the park and we're curious about it and, you know, privately talked about, oh, gosh, it would be really cool if we could just go dig holes in this park. But, you know, and then later, Jason was doing a project in Patterson Park with Baltimore Heritage for the War of 1812 celebration. And some of our neighbors visited their open house and got really excited about this whole public archaeology, public history, and went to Baltimore Heritage and said, what do we have to do to get an archaeological project in our neighborhood? And they were kind enough to tell them, hey, you've got two archaeologists that live in your neighborhood. Maybe you should talk to them. So they did, and we were super pumped about it, and the rest is history.
Lisa mentioned the mill race. What other kinds of physical clues told you we got to dig here?
So we have the mill race. As Lisa explained, it goes, typically mill races lead to a mill. The mill is no longer present, but there is a gigantic pit that is at the end of the mill race. That pit is where the mill once stood. So that was another indication. Also, by the mill race, there is an old farm road, which actually took us a little while to figure out. But now it's used as a social trail that's located just in the woods. And then one of the more prominent features in the park is the former Utah Methodist Church. It's located in the Hall Springs area across from a historic springhead that was used by the community going back to the 1820s. and the springhead is still present. And then above the springhead on a hill is what was left of the church. The church was founded in about 1850 by the family who owned the property, the Halls, and they donated the property to a small congregation of Methodists, and they started a church and named the church after what the plantation was named after, Utah. And that was then converted by the park as a pavilion. So it's still standing.
So I'm a little confused about what were the clues that you saw versus what the history that you've learned since then. What you just described was a very complete sort of piece of history. Did you know all that at the beginning, or is some of that what you've learned?
We did know about the church. We knew about the spring. But a lot of the other details, the more intricate details about the roads and things like that, were came out as we did our historical research. One of the first things that we did after we were approached by our neighbors was to look at the property history to see, well, was anything ever here? So we delved into land records, historic maps, and typically, Lisa could probably attest to it as well, when you do archaeology, you have some inkling of what there is in the historical document, like in the historical records, but usually not a wealth of information. You don't have like George Washington level documentation. But in this instance, we did. So it was...
You did have...
Have the documentation. So we had maps showing the actual house that we ended up excavating, other structural features in the park. And using those maps, we were able to georeference them on top of existing maps.
So you knew when you started to dig that you were going to find a big manor?
No.
Lisa's shaking her head.
We did eventually put all of those things together. But in the beginning, the historic maps don't line up perfectly with modern topography, modern maps. So when we first started excavating, we just went out on our weekends and explored. We dig these little shovel tests. I kind of compare it to Battleship, where you just dig in a grid a small hole by hand with a shovel. And if you hit something good, then you kind of focus in that area because you're probably in an archaeological site. And we did that in the area where the Utah Manor House now stands. And we just found a wealth of historic artifacts. We had no idea what specifically that was. And the timeline that we'd established for starting a little neighborhood archaeology project that we thought would take a couple of weekends maybe was pretty rapid. So we said, you know what, this looks good. We want people to be able to come out, see what archaeology is like. But importantly, we want them to be able to find something, because if you're doing archaeology professionally, not finding something, you can tell yourself negative information is still information. But if you're a volunteer, going out and digging a hole and finding nothing is not a satisfactory outcome. So we found a lot of artifacts there. We thought, that looks interesting, we'll go there. And we initially thought, because of the proximity to where we thought the mill was, that this might be the miller's house. But then as we continued to excavate during our first season there, it became clear, oh no, this is something completely different.
Much bigger.
Much, much bigger.
This is On the Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with Lisa Krause and Jason Schellenhammer about the Herring Run Archaeology Project in Northeast Baltimore. This month, they were awarded the 2018 Maryland Preservation Award for Outstanding Individual Leadership because of the project. What has surprised you? Or has it all surprised you?
I think the thing that surprised us was the level of interest that there was in an archaeology project. We really thought that this would be a couple of weekends and then we'd stop doing it and that would be the end. And now here we are 4 years later. We've had hundreds and hundreds of volunteers and visitors to the site. And it's fantastic. We're always really excited about archaeology, but seeing our community and people from all over the state who have an interest and find value in what we do is amazing. And then on top of that, to have a site that's so surprising and wonderful and exciting and important is just a fantastic, wonderful surprise.
So one of the other surprising things was how we partners came out of the woodwork. So we started off with Baltimore Heritage. But then we had the Natural History Society of Maryland was interested, and they've given us lab space to do our artifact analysis during the winter. So we do field work during the spring, but the project carries on throughout the year. So we may only be out in the field for about a week, but we're doing about 6 to 7 months worth of post-processing, processing artifacts, washing them, identifying them, and then labeling them.
And when you say we, that's you and the volunteers.
And the volunteers, yeah. Yeah, and it's going on right now. But then in addition, one of the other things was we're digging in a place that you typically aren't allowed to dig. It's a public park. So getting permission from Baltimore City Rec and Parks was one of the early questions. Will they let us just have a public excavation in the park? And we were very surprised as to how amenable they were to it. And in fact, I think the people at Rec and Parks are some of our biggest supporters.
So what kind of training do you give volunteers?
Everything.
Which means what?
So one of the things that Jason and I both really wanted to do was when we were kids, we have wanted to do this forever. And our parents would take us to museums or to projects where archaeology was happening. And, you know, you were always at a remove. You could see it happening or you could see the objects in a museum cabinet, but you couldn't touch anything. You couldn't touch stuff. You couldn't dig a hole. You couldn't do any of that. And we really wanted to make this something where people show up in a park outside and they're working, they're doing archaeology immediately. It's hands-on. We train them how to dig, how to screen, how to identify artifacts, how to analyze soil stratigraphy, anything about archaeology that they want to learn. If they have questions, we answer those. And then in the lab, they're learning how to not just wash artifacts, but to identify them and catalog them and how to do the analysis. So it's anything that we can teach people that they want to learn, that's what we do, the whole process.
The website of the Herring Run Archaeology Project says, quote, archaeology of the people, by the people, for the people, end quote, which kind of sounds like a credo. Talk about that.
I think it's really important for people to see how history is made. And if the history of a community or a city is being discovered and created from what we find, I think it's great for the people who live there to have a role in that. There's not a huge amount of published information about the history of Northeast Baltimore. What we're learning is changing people's ideas about the length of time that people have lived there and what they did when they were there and what the seeds of our community are.
And this stretches back.
It stretches back
further than people realize.
Yes. So an earlier component of the site dates to approximately 1680 to 1740. It's the earliest occupation of that particular location. It's separate from the Utah Manor House, but it's there. And having a part in that discovery and telling that story is really important, I think, for communities. It's incredibly powerful. And archaeology can do that in a really unique way because people pick up an artifact and they're the first person to touch that for 150 or 200 years. And it's their past in their hand in a tangible way that nothing else can really even touch. So that's what I mean of by and for.
Yeah. And just to build on that, typical of archaeologists, we have a story that we want to tell that we think the artifacts tell us, but our volunteers have their own stories that they're interested in. And one of the major components is working with them constantly. I mean, when we're out at the site, like, what are you interested in? What do you want to hear about? What do you want to know about? What do you think this site can tell you? And doing that, it creates our own research questions. So we're not creating the research questions for them and to tell them about their past. We're all learning about our past together.
Really interesting. We need to take a quick break here. Jason Schellenhammer and Lisa Kraus, archaeologists and directors of the Herring Run Archaeology Project in Northeast Baltimore, an archaeological dig that welcomes the public to participate this Sunday at 2 p.m. at the Engineers Club of Baltimore, 11 West Mount Vernon Place. They'll speak about the project. We have a link to more information at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. After the break, how the artifacts they're finding piece together a story that connects to some prominent Baltimore families. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us.
The This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Today we're talking about the Herring Run Archaeology Project in Northeast Baltimore's Herring Run Park. Archaeologist Jason Schellenhammer and Lisa Krause are with us. They direct the project, now in its fourth year. When you speak at the Engineers Club on Sunday afternoon, I understand you will explain how the stories you're piecing together are connected to some prominent Baltimore families. So give us the highlights of what you've discovered.
The site itself was a house that was owned by William Smith. William Smith was a Baltimore merchant, and he also was a member of the Continental Congress. After the war, he then served as the U.S. House of Representatives, our first representative in Baltimore.
Baltimore's first representative,
yes,
in the federal Congress.
Yes, he won by 3 votes. And so if you ever say that your vote doesn't count, that's a perfect example of how it does. He served one term. He had several children, several daughters, and they all married prominent people in Maryland, including Josiah Carville Hall of Harford County. The Halls eventually inherited the property.
The property that we've been talking about.
Yes,
the property
Utah.
You're excavating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they inherited it in 1804. It was Janet Smith and her husband, Josiah Carville Hall. And then the Halls remained on the property till 1865 when it burnt down during a christening party. The Halls then, their descendants, married other very prominent Baltimoreans, including Horatio Whitridge, a few other doctors and merchants in Baltimore, and those individuals then intermarried with the Garrett family.
And the what is the significance, do you think, of the fact that this property, which had been forgotten for, at least a century, the even existence of this house, was at some point such a nexus of so many connections of powerful people in Baltimore?
I think it's really interesting because William Smith, who most people probably have not heard of, we had not heard of him when we started this project. And the more we learn about him, we feel that's terribly unjust that everybody should know about William Smith, because he and his family and the people that he worked with made Baltimore into a city. They actually pushed the Baltimore City Charter. They came from Pennsylvania. They were merchants. They came for the port. But then they saw the potential for a city here, and they made that happen. So sort of the origins of Baltimore come out of, you know, the people who lived in this house. And then as their fortunes faded a little bit in the middle 1840s, I imagine it kind of like Pride and Prejudice, where you have a family with many daughters. They, the daughters of the household were the Mrs. Hall. They turn up referred to that way. So-and-so married a Miss Hall.
The as Mrs., M-I-S-S-E-S.
Yes, yes. The multiple Mrs. of Utah. So, and a daughter of Utah ended up marrying T. Harrison Garrett, who was the son of John Work Garrett of the B&O Railroad. And T. Harrison Garrett and Alice Hall Whitridge Garrett moved to Evergreen House, which is now quite a fabulous museum. And you see these little, you know, connections spreading out across the city. It's very Smalltimore then and now.
This is On the Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with archaeologists Lisa Krause and Jason Schellenhammer. They direct the Herring Run Archaeology Project in Northeast Baltimore. In a video created for the Maryland Preservation Award presented to you both this month, Jason, you say that archaeology sheds light on the lives of those whom history doesn't record. You talked about, quote, the enslaved, the indentured, and the tenants, end quote. Amplify on that.
I'm glad you asked. Okay, so that's one of our other really surprising stories. So you have the Smith and Halls who lived on the property, and we know a lot about them because things were written about them. We have newspaper accounts, we have journals, we have letters between John Adams and his wife about William Smith. But what we don't have are records about the individuals who also lived there who were enslaved on the property. And there were at times upwards of 24 individuals who were enslaved at Utah.
And we know this how?
We know this from census documents, from inventories. So when one of the family members died in 1843, Benedict William Aull, his inventory included 15 enslaved people by name, by their first name. And as we've been doing research, we've actually discovered that there was essentially two extended families living at Utah. There were the Smith Hall families, and then there was also the Getting Jones families. There was a woman named Henrietta Gettings. Her mother was enslaved by Benedict William Hall's father, and she was manumitted in 1817, but all of her children remained enslaved. And Henrietta had her own children, about five, we think, possibly more. And one of those daughters was actually given away as a wedding gift to one of the daughters, as when she got married.
One of the Hall daughters.
One of the Mrs. Halls. So Elizabeth Hall got married in 1843. And as a gift, one of the girls that she grew up with lived in the house with her. Her name was at that time Emmeline Gettings, went to live with Elizabeth. Elizabeth and her husband Horatio eventually manumit her. And Emmeline becomes a fabulously famous cook and chef, moves to New York City, is one of several people who are given the honor of inventing the potato chip, the Saratoga chip. And in 1888, she was interviewed by the New York Times, a full-page article discussing her life, and she mentions the Halls, and she says she had nothing bad to say about Baltimore. But we don't have anything about their daily lives. We have these highlights, and thanks to just an amazing historic record, but we know nothing about the daily lives of these people, and that's what artifacts allow us to do. They didn't get the opportunity to write their own records, but what they did get to do is leave materials behind that we can piece those stories together. So in a way, those artifacts are their stories.
I don't know how one ever knows when you're done with an archaeological dig, but assuming you have some sense of that, how far along are you? What proportion of what there is to find have you found? What happens next?
Well, Lisa and I are both smiling. It's a very good thing. When are you done? So we really did anticipate only being there for maybe a couple of years, doing a couple of digs with the public. And one part of it is that we just have public support. It's phenomenal, and they always are asking when we're going back out. But the other thing is that we have an amazing site that we only know a fraction of. So we're also responsible archaeologists. We like to think that we're responsible. We don't want to fully excavate the site because we know that we have questions now, but there will be archaeologists and just people generally in the future who might have other questions, and we want to leave a portion of the site left for them to study. Because once you pull it out of the ground, it's gone. Some of that information you can never get back. That's why we record everything. But there might be new methodologies, new techniques in order to do archaeology in the future, and we don't want to ruin basically the future's opportunity to learn something. That being said, we have been there for 4 years, and I feel like every time we finish a field season, we're like, that's it, we're done. But then February rolls around, and we're ready to go back out. So I think we're feeling it right now that this might be the last year at this site. That being said, we have years of analysis and volunteer work to do.
And there are other sites that we identified in the park, and there's one in particular that we have our eye on for the year after this.
Will you come back and tell us about that one?
If you want us to, we'd be delighted.
Well, it's been great talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you
so much.
Archaeologists Jason Schellenhammer and Lisa Krauss direct the Herring Run Archaeology Project in Northeast Baltimore. Their talk titled "The Archaeology of Everyone Who's Anyone, How Herring Run Park Tells the Story of Baltimore's High Society," starts at 2 p.m. this Sunday, February 18th, at the Engineers Club of Baltimore, 11 West Mount Vernon Place. We have a link to the information about that and how you can get involved in the Herring Run Project, all at the On the Record page at WIPR.org. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks!